We have a very special speaker tonight. We've been listening to Chris since 1999 that he had a thing. And then we have newer tapes from Chris also. And you know, you can hear the growth. All the people we listen to, you can hear from when they first start doing this, and their spirit grows and gets bigger and bigger. And how did Chris happen to get here tonight? Well, back that. And Barbara Sponti went to see Chris last year, or 2 years ago, at the High Falls, Camp Epworth, right? Camp Epworth Roundup or whatever it was. Can't remember what it was called. Facebook study, right? And Pat was very taken, and Barbara was very taken by the clear message that Chris had portrayed. And then, last year was that we were up in Saratoga. A lot of us went up to Saratoga. And Chris was speaking with Katie.
It was Jonathan and Marcia Stone.
Jonathan and Marcia from Texas, right? And they did a thing on the Working With Others 12th Step. It was totally amazing, you know? And Pat got him signed up. Been a year since he's come. Yeah, they got together and signed. They brought the guests on the phone during time. And Chris is coming here to speak with us. And I'm very honored to have Chris S. New Jersey to share with us our 19th anniversary.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's really, really great to be up here. Obviously, this is one of those pockets of enthusiasm where you know people are about the business of recovery, and the fellowship is really strong. You know, I could see that the minute I walked through the door. So you have a great group up here, and I like the way that we started with the set aside prayer. You know, one of the things that I think is important for all of us is we need to be paying attention to our own personal spiritual growth. I think that's the treatment for alcoholism, is spiritual growth. You know, one of the amazing things about what Bill and Bob learned back in the 30s about alcoholism, listen, that they both had their lives torn up by alcoholism, and they discovered that spiritual growth was going to be the solution to their alcoholism. And the thing that they discovered that was one of the first times I think anybody ever discovered it is, you don't treat alcoholism with sobriety. They had tried to stay sober. Many of them had stayed sober for months and months at a time. Always the time and the place came where they put alcohol back in their body. So treating alcoholism with sobriety just wasn't working for them. They had to have something deeper. They had to have spiritual growth. Now, the set-aside prayer is wonderful. You know, one of the things that I do that I gain a lot of comfort from is comparative religious studies, comparative spiritual studies. I discovered a bookstore over in Socrates that is incredible. It's got all kinds of wonderful books on spirituality and stuff. My wife and I were there today. You know, I love reading about this stuff, but what I believe is very, very necessary for us is to continue to grow spiritually. Now, the way to do that is to have an open mind. So in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it asks us, and it says, we beg of you to lay aside your old ideas, you know, so that you may be open to a new experience. And, you know, that is so important. I've met people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are closed-minded. They've learned what they needed to know in their first 90 days in AA, and they're not open to anything else. And you know, if they do end up staying sober, there's no real growth. There's no real the quality of life doesn't seem to change very much for those people. But for the people who pay attention and continue to put work into their spiritual lives, their lives just continue to get better and better. There's a great promise in the big book. It says, the most satisfactory years of your life are ahead of you. You know, that's an incredible promise. That means no matter where you are, no matter what your life circumstances, the best years of your life are ahead of you. I don't know about anybody else, but when I was drinking, I was my last like 10 years of drinking, I was trying to recapture when alcohol was working for me, like in high school. You know, when I wasn't like a vomiting wretch by the time the night was over. You know, it was actually working for me, and I was always living in the past. One of the promises of recovery is that we get to live in the future. Now, I am an alcoholic. I understand alcoholism at a serious level today. I didn't understand it when I was drinking. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I knew that I drank too much. I knew that I drank more than you did. I knew that I got in a lot of trouble with alcohol, but I didn't understand alcoholism. One of the crazy things is when you get involved in AA and you get involved in recovery, you catch alcoholism. You know, you start to understand what the illness is and you start to identify. And you say, yeah, that's me. And especially when you start reading the big book and the 12 and 12, you start to identify with the alcoholic thinking, the alcoholic mindset. And I believe alcoholism is genetic. I mean, you know, folks, the science is in. Alcoholism really, it's a genetic bullet. It's not causal. I used to think that I was an alcoholic because I drank too much. I now understand that I drank too much because I'm an alcoholic. The alcoholism came first. You know, it came before the alcohol. And I understand that today because the treatment for alcoholism treated the spiritual malady that I had within me since I was a child. My first understanding of alcoholism, you know, now, knowing what I know now, I recognize took place when I was 5 years old. My mother came into the room one day and she says, get dressed, you know, grab your stuff. Today's your first day in kindergarten. And I remember she packed me up, she put me in the car, she took me across town, she opened up the door, she said, there's the kindergarten, you know, have at it, I'll be back in 4 or 5 hours, and she drove away. And I was on my own. I remember standing up on this hill, looking down, there's kids playing, and playing kickball and tag, they're already friends. I'm standing up on the hill, filled with self-centered fear, like, oh my God, you know, whose idea was this kindergarten crap, you know? This is not working for me. I mean, you know, I gotta go down there with all those people. I mean, I had unbelievable anxiety and self-centered fear. But I understood at a deep level that I needed to do it. I had to do it. I couldn't just run away. So I walked down, you know, I acted as if I wasn't freaking out, and I walked down and I started my kindergarten year. I gotta tell you, every second of that was uncomfortable. Every second of that was uncomfortable. And why do I think that has to do with alcoholism? Because you know what would have really made that day easier? A pint of vodka. You know what I mean? You give me some vodka, I'd have been the kindergarten kid. You know, I'd have been the funniest. Everybody would have wanted to be my friend. Instead, I was like this. You know, like, oh, they're looking at me. You know, alcohol for an alcoholic. Alcohol is more of a solution than it is a problem. And there's a reason why we drink. I'll tell you one story that'll explain kind of like what this means to me. In my last couple of years of drinking, I was a bad electrician working for a bad contractor. It was just my whole life just terrible. My family had left me. You know, I just got my license back from multiple DUIs. I had a $100 car. I was living with mom. You know, I mean, the whole alcoholic gamut. And what I would do is, as soon as I got off of work, I would make a beeline for the liquor store every single time. And I would go in, and if it was the summer or spring, I'd be drinking vodka. If it was the winter or fall, I'd be drinking bourbon. And I knew right where they were, and I had an understanding with the owner of the liquor store not to run out of my stuff. You know, we had an understanding. And I would go in there, and I would make a beeline for it. I'd grab my booze. I'd go up. I'd pay for it. And as I'm walking out the door, I'd start to feel like, you know what I mean? I'm not even drinking it yet, and I'm getting that sense of relief, like I got my booze. And I remember this one time, I grabbed my bottle, and I'm extra anxious to stay, and I walk up, and normally I could pay and I could go. But this one day, there's this lady who's like hogging the line, and she's asking the guy behind the cash register, "Hey, what kind of wine goes with tilapia?" You know, and I'm like, "What?" And the guy's like answering her. You know what I mean? He's like, "Well, you know, there's a Cabernet, you know, from the California region, you know, with a nice blush." And I'm like, "Are you kidding me? You got a vodka buyer here? You know, get the wine lady out of my way. Are you nuts? Or you just give her a bottle of Gallo, get her the hell out of the way. I gotta buy this stuff. I gotta go. I got a problem. Oh, I'm sober. You know what I mean? That's my problem. My problem is I'm sober. Now, does that sound like alcohol is the problem? Alcohol never was the problem. You know what I mean? There's this guy who tells this great story. He goes, he was always afraid of dogs because he got bit when he was a kid. So his whole life he was afraid of dogs. And he gets into therapy and they go back and they try to examine like what happened when he got bit by the dog was he was chasing a girl across her yard and the dog bit him. Her dog bit him. And he goes, "I realized dogs never were my problem." You know what I mean? My problem was I was chasing girls all my life. It's the same thing kind of happened with me with alcohol. Alcohol never was my problem. My problem was the spiritual condition within me. I was uncomfortable with myself and my environment. I needed sobriety was not enough for me. And my first exposure to people who were trying to help me with my drinking, they would say, "Well, why don't you just cut back? Or why don't you just quit?" And trying to explain to an alcoholic that they should give up alcohol, that's like, there's no way you can even get through to an alcoholic when you're saying that. It's like, you're telling them to give up the one thing they think is still working for them, The one thing that's still their friend. I remember I lost everything in life, everything. And, I'm up at a desk in my room at my mother's house. And my family had fled. I didn't have any friends left. I had no money. I had a terrible job, $100 car. And it was me and I would talk to the bottle. It's like, "It's you and me." Just insane. Insane. So when you go up to an alcoholic, if you say, "Just don't drink and come to some meetings with me," you're not offering them enough. I don't know about anybody else, but I need more than that. Sobriety becomes untenable for me. And if you don't have something more powerful than just staying sober, I'm not going to think you have an answer for me. The sad thing is today that there's over 10 million people out there who have gone through Alcoholics Anonymous for one reason or another, have not stayed, and are out there in the world telling everybody who asks them that, "Oh yeah, I went to AA, it didn't work for me, or I didn't like it." I think a lot of them might be heavy drinkers, a lot of them might not have belonged here anyway. But the thing is I know that sometimes we don't offer the newcomer enough. Enough to want to really stay here, really plug in and really change and really recover. I got sober in the North Jersey area in 1989. And what it looked like in 1989 was it was very, very fellowship heavy. In other words, you would go to AA, you would do maybe a 90 and 90, and you would come away convinced that Alcoholics Anonymous' program is a program of meeting attendance. That's really what I thought, you would come away thinking about this. But I've got to tell you, one thing I know today, I absolutely know, is meetings don't treat alcoholism. Going to meetings does not treat alcoholism. what happens is going to meetings are a good thing. Please do not get me wrong. Going to meetings brings us to the climate where we can discover the recovery work. You know, that's really what the fellowship was for. That's what the fellowship was about. And somewhere along the line, we started to put together way too many meetings, and we started to lose sight of our primary purpose, which is to recover from alcoholism and to help other alcoholics. And it became a meeting thing. I think it happened because, there was the Hughes Act around 1970 or so, and what that did was that made it incumbent upon treatment providers and hospitals and insurance companies to treat for alcoholism. So they threw up a million treatment centers, and people would come out of those treatment centers, and the main therapeutic in those treatment centers was group. So they would come out of these treatment centers and they'd want to do group. They'd want to do a discussion meeting. And that's really kind of what happened to us. There was a period of time where discussion meetings were rare. They had them, but that wasn't the main type of meeting. And so all of a sudden when I got sober, all there were discussion meetings. There were some step meetings and stuff, and there was a couple of speaker meetings, but it was mainly discussion meetings. And I found it very, very difficult to change the way I needed to change by going to these meetings. So here I am. I'm going to some AA meetings. It's like 1990 or so, and I'm desperate. You got to understand. My last drunk. What happened during my last drunk? It was between Christmas and New Year's, and the whole family came home, and I went into a drunken blackout, and I threatened all their lives, like my entire family. I'm going to kill all of you, you know? And when I came out of that particular blackout and I realized what I had done, I got to tell you, you know, it talks about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the jumping off place. We can no longer believe that we can live with alcohol, and we don't believe that we can live without it. We're at a place of desperation. You know, and they call that the jumping off point. And that's exactly where I was when I came out of this blackout. And I was desperate. I went back to AA. I'd been trying AA since 1984. But I went back in, and I went back in with a willingness born of desperation. I didn't think AA was going to work for me. You know how we are. We walk into an AA room, and you know people are praying, and you got the steps up on the wall, and you're like, what's going on here? You know, and somebody's talking about the fan belt on their Mercedes or something, and you're new, and you're like, what does this have to do with my drinking? You know, you just don't know. But I went back into AA, and I was going to a ton of meetings. I was going to maybe 12 meetings a week. And it even got to the point where I started to look good. You know, we can fake it pretty good. You know, and people were patting me on the head. Chris, you're doing really good. You know, I see you at all the meetings, you know, and you're starting to share. You're doing, you know, you're doing really good. And I'm like, yeah, I'm doing really good. Okay. You know, but really what was happening was I was trying to treat my alcoholism with meeting attendance. And this is what was going on. I was out of my mind. I had physical sobriety, but I had all of the malady was on me. Like I'd be sitting in one of those discussion meetings, and I'd be sitting there like this, and you know, I'd be looking good, you know, I'd be smiling, and somebody'd be sharing, and I'm thinking, you know, what a hypocrite. Listen to this guy share. Oh my God, you know, oh yeah, sure. And I'd look over, and this guy, every single meeting he's got to share, he's raising his hand. Oh no, he's raising his hand. Oh please don't call him. Please, I can't hear it. I can't hear it. One more time. Get it. Please. Oh, they called on him. Oh my God. Now I got to hear him share about his family. Oh, tell somebody who cares. He's grateful now. Oh, he's grateful. Oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to go outside, I'm going to slash all four of his tires, and then I'm going to follow him out after the meeting out because I want to see what gratitude really looks like. And I'm going to go, thanks for sharing. You know? I mean, I'm out of my mind, and I can't tell anybody that these are the thoughts that are going through my head. They'll lock me up. You know what I mean? You know, so I'm faking it till I make it, and I'm out of my mind. And one day I was hanging out with this guy, Radio Shack Mike. Okay, Radio Shack Mike was a real piece of work. He was one of these guys that he got arrested for cocaine or whatever. He never really drank, but he showed up in AA. A lot of people who had very little alcohol history were showing up in AA back in the early 90s, because the treatment centers were telling them a drug is a drug is a drug, you know. So they're all coming in, and I make friends with this guy. Now I knew there was something different about him, because he was happy the minute he got into AA. He was happy. I'm like, what is wrong with you? Why aren't you miserable? You know, what's the matter with you? But anyway, we became friends because we were both crazy, and we'd drive the meetings a lot together. And he was a guy who really started to get involved in the spiritual stuff. He would go to these New Age bookstores, and he'd buy the newest book, and it would be like Pyramid Power, and he'd be like, Chris, you got to get a pyramid, you know. And the next week it would be the Course in Miracles. Chris, you got to do the course. He was like one of those guys who was just you know, soaking up everything. And I would try something. One time he talked me into doing some affirmations. He gave me some affirmation tapes. And he goes, yeah, you just play them and you stand in front of the mirror and you do what they tell you to do. And I remember, so I'm trying it, and the affirmation tape is going, say to yourself 100 times or until you believe it that you're a wonderful guy. So I remember I'm looking in the mirror, I'm going, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. I'm not a wonderful guy. You know, throw the tape deck. I'm trying to treat alcoholism with affirmations, you know. I am definitely going to a gunfight with a penknife. It's just not working. And you have to throw the tapes away. You're out of your mind. If that works for you, you're nuts. And this one day he comes and he hands me 8 90-minute cassette tapes. And he goes, you're hardcore, you know. You like these. And I'm like, well, what are they? And he goes, they're a big book study. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, a couple of guys from Arkansas do this big book study. I'm like, Arkansas? And I'm doing the math, okay? 8 90-minute tapes, that's 12 hours of listening to guys from Arkansas. You know, kill me now. You know, but he makes me promise to listen to him. So I do. I've got kind of a long ride to work these days, and so I put him in, and I'm starting to listen to Joe and Charlie, the late, great Joe and Charlie. And for the first time in my life, I'm hearing a message of a hope, a message of recovery. But I'm getting pissed, because this is not my experience, okay? I'm going to 12 meetings a week. You know, I'm the secretary over here. I'm driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting over there. I'm doing all this stuff. I'm like Mr. AA, you know. And they're telling me I don't have a program. Because the first thing I recognize listening to this tape is they're basically saying right to me, Chris, if you're not working the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have an AA program, because that's what an AA program is. And if you don't have an AA program, when you go back out, please don't tell people AA didn't work, because the 12 steps is what AA is. And this was a message I did not want to hear. You got to understand, you know, I'm the treasurer over here. I'm the cookie guy at this one meeting. And I don't know what else I could do. And these guys from Arkansas, I don't hear any of this stuff in any of the meetings I'm going to. The closest I ever get to it is when they read How It Works, you know, when they're reading the first part of chapter 5. What happens, folks, is when you get hit with the truth about your alcoholism, it hurts. You get pissed off, but you have to deal with it. You have to deal with it. If you're going to stay sober, if you're going to move forward, if you're not going to remain miserable, you have to deal with it. So it haunted me. This the lessons that I got from these tapes haunted me. But you got to understand, if Joe and Charlie were right, my sponsor and everybody I knew in my groups was wrong. This was the conflict I had. How can everybody that loves me and I love be wrong? How can my sponsor, Fish Food Phil, be wrong? You know, how can he be wrong? I put him on a pedestal. He's like, oh, Phil, you know. Minnesota, and so it was difficult for me to deal with this information. But what happened is, listen, life comes at us. Just because we get sober doesn't mean that the semis don't come rolling over our life. And there was a period of time where a bunch of different things happened to me. I lost a job, a state caught up with me because of fleeing to avoid prosecution, I broke up with a girlfriend, a whole bunch of bad stuff happened. And I was crippled. I had no way to deal with this. I was emotionally as raw as I could possibly be. And what I believe today is, if you're a real alcoholic, the type of alcoholic that the book Alcoholics Anonymous describes, if you fit that category, what's going to happen to you if you don't work a spiritual program of recovery? Three things are going to happen. One of them, you'll take your own life, because we're over 60 times more likely to take our lives than non-alcoholics. You'll take your own life. You'll go crazy, and they'll have to medicate you up until you're just drooling 24/7. Or you'll drink. Those are your three options if you're a real alcoholic and you don't work a spiritual program of recovery. You're not going to make. You can't just stay sober. It doesn't work. The Big Book explains 50 different ways that if you can stay sober without a spiritual program of recovery, you're not an alcoholic. It explains that 70 different ways. So what was going on was I wasn't treating my alcoholism. I'm about 9 months sober. I'm ready to just go crazy. And I remember I went over to my sponsor's house. I just surprised them. Now, this was very unusual. I would never do this. I wouldn't just show up unannounced. It wasn't done. And I remember I went over to his house, knocked on the door, and he came to the door. He goes, "Chris?" And I couldn't even talk. I was so shattered. I was just like this, right? And he said, come on in. He asked me. And you know how sponsors are. You come to them with these enormous problems. And they come back to you with, "Have you prayed?" "Let me go through this again slower." You obviously didn't hear. Well, and he started to talk to me about prayer. He goes, "Do you pray?" I'm like, "No." You know, he goes, "Well, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pray." And I'm thinking, why did I come to this guy? You know, I want him to help me get my girlfriend back. I want him to tell me what to do to get the cops off my back and to tell me where I can get another job. You know, those are my problems. He was incredibly wise. He was incredibly wise, though, because here's the truth of the matter. A good sponsor will always do this. The symptoms were losing the job, you know, having the cops come after me, losing the girlfriend. That was symptoms of my untreated alcoholism. He knew that it's a waste of time to help somebody with the symptoms. He went right to the cause and condition of my problems. And the cause and condition of my problems was lack of spiritual practices, lack of attention to spiritual details. So he started to get me to pray. Now, another thing I did was I started to loosen up a little bit about these Joe and Charlie guys. It always haunted me. It always haunted me in the back of my mind that they understood on a very deep level what was going on with me. So I remember I pulled these tapes back out. I started to listen to them again. I got my Big Book out, and I blew the dust off of it. I got a Big Book when I went to treatment about a year earlier, okay? More than a year, about 2 years earlier. And I went to this terrible treatment center. You know, today I'm very, very involved at a pretty decent level with professional addiction and alcoholism treatment. I really understand the good, and I understand the average, and I understand the bad. And I went to a really bad treatment center, and I'll tell you why. I had one half an hour counseling session, one-on-one, with a counselor in 28 days, if you could imagine, one half an hour one-on-one. All the rest of it, what do you think the rest of it was? That's exactly right. Where you sit in a circle and you talk about your day. well, Chris, what was your day like? You know, there's somebody. I remember this. I'm sitting in group. There's this one guy who just wouldn't shut up. He would take 45 minutes of the group every single time, and I'd be like, would you shut up? Why don't you just drink? You know, and get the hell out of here. You know, I want to share. You know, I mean, it was just. Listen, trying to treat alcoholism with group, that's like trying to treat herpes with architecture. It's like, it's a complete wrong discipline, you know what I mean? It makes absolutely no sense. Anyway, that's a mental health model. It has nothing to do with somebody who's got a spiritual malady. Anyway, I blew the dust off of this big book, and I remember opening it up, and it was a big book. You know how I don't know anybody that's been in treatment, but you get people to sign your big book when you're leaving? And I'm looking through this, and it's got stuff like, Chris, you're the craziest bastard I ever met. You're never going to make it. Love, Harry. You know, there's like all these things in the book. It's like, oh, my God. And, you know, I must have been bad. You know what I mean? But anyway, I start listening to the Joe and Charlie tapes. I got a big book open, and I got a pen, and I got a notebook, and I start to do what they're telling me to do. I start to go through it like it's a textbook, and like I'm being taught by Joe and Charlie, and I'm doing the exercises. Now, this was really, really unorthodox. I mean, nobody was doing this in the groups that I was in. At most, they were going to step meetings. And at step meetings, what was going on back around my area, where people were going to step meetings and they were sharing about steps, they were listening to the steps, they were reading the steps, they were thinking about the steps, they were philosophizing about the steps, and sometimes they'd share about what it might be like someday if they ever took the steps. You know, that was what the step meetings were. So here I am. I'm starting to go through this. I'm starting to go through this book, and I'm starting to pay attention to it. Now, the book Alcoholics Anonymous is our basic text. It's a textbook for our society. Very few people had experience with it where I came from when I first got sober. That's really changing today. I can hear it and I can feel it in this group that it's changed up here too. But think about this. Let's just say, for instance, that you recognized in your life that you needed calculus to be able to work out problems, okay? And you went and you signed up at the at college, and you're going to the calculus class, right? And you're sitting in the calculus classroom. You got the book closed, and you're listening to calculus. You know, you're raising your hand. You're sharing about calculus, and you know, you get a calculus sponsor, and you're grateful for calculus. But you never open up the textbook and you never learn to solve the problems. Would that not be insane? You know, you'd be completely wasting your money. Well, that's what all of us were doing in my groups. We were going to AA and we're sharing about AA, and we've got no real practical experience about recovery. You know, so what I learned from the Joe and Charlie thing, and listen, I started to do the steps in a very imperfect way, and I did not address the steps to be a better AA guy. I did them because I was desperate and I just couldn't feel the way I felt emotionally anymore. I could not stand my quality of life. I couldn't stand how I felt about myself. I couldn't stand my internal condition. And Joe and Charlie had kind of told me that the problem was I hadn't done the steps. So I listened to that and I started to do them. And I started to go through the book. And I did things like I did the inventories. I remember going to my sponsor and saying, I want to do another fifth step. And he's like, well, didn't you share all your stuff with me earlier? I go, yeah, but you know, this is a different thing. I want to come and I want to do a fifth step with you. And I remember I pulled out the inventory list and he goes, what's all that? Where's your story? You know, aren't you just going to tell your story? And I go, no, I'm doing this different. I'm trying to follow some instructions. You know, do me a favor and let's go through this. So he goes, okay, fine. So I read through the inventories, and I did the fifth step, and then I moved into step six and step seven and steps eight and steps nine, and I started to go out and I started to actually do amends, because I was convinced by now I'm buying more tapes. I'm buying more big book tapes. And I discovered a couple of guys who I'm very, very lucky to be able to say ended up becoming my mentors and very good friends of mine. But Joe H. and Mark H., I started to listen to some of their workshops. And that was, that. You know, Joe and Charlie were like secondary school. Mark and Joe was like going to graduate school. It was like a whole different experience for him. And they were the ones really that convinced me that I need to not have unfinished amends. They convinced me that the difference between having unfinished amends and not having any unfinished amends that you haven't addressed to the best of your ability is like the difference between night and day. And I started to believe that, and I started to really, really put some effort into this recovery work. Now by this time, you know, I'm changing. This work will change you, fundamentally change you at depth. You know, your personality is going to change. Your attitude, your outlook is going to change. Your belief systems are going to become different. You're going to, you know, all of the promises that they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous are going to start to manifest through you. You will know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, you will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. All of these promises start to come through, and you know, you're operating on a different plane. It's just a completely different life experience. And, you know, when I first started to do the steps, I was a bad electrician in a bad job, not even caring. You know, all I wanted to do was do 8 hours worth of work and then leave me alone. I didn't need a lot of money. You know, I needed enough money to pay insurance on my car, you know, buy some CDs, maybe some clothes every once in a while, and that's about it. Don't bother me with this career stuff or anything. I just want to do my time, get my paycheck, and be left alone, you know, the rest of the time. And that's really the way it was. Well, what changed in my life is I started to become more ethical. I started to be able to pay attention more. I started to care a little bit more about what my bosses wanted. And this, I wasn't concentrating on this, but what happened was I became more employable. I became more trustworthy. And over the course of a number of years, I just kept getting promoted up and getting better and better job offers. My relationships, my last couple of years drinking, the people who would have anything to do with me, and there were not a lot of them, were usually stone drug addicts or stone alcoholics. Most of them didn't even have real names. You know, I swear, you know, one of them was Weezer and the other was Green Man, you know, and there was one guy named Whack. And then there was a guy who you called Rat, and he would always say Rat with two T's. You know, he made that distinction. It wasn't just a one T Rat. You know, and these were the people that I was hanging out with. Now you get sober, you start practicing spiritual principles in your life, and you start to become a different person. You start to attract different people. You know, those kind of people stay away from me now. You know, like the Rats and the Weezers. They don't come anywhere near me. You know, I'm not even the kind of guy I would have liked when I first got sober today. You know, but what happens is you start to attract different people in your life. Better people, people that are more trustworthy, people that are more loyal, more, you know, understanding what friendships really are. The kind of friends who are going to really be there for you. And in a very short period of time, I had a gigantic crew of people, whether they were my sponsees or my friends. And, you know, these are the type of people, like, if you're in trouble, man, they come out of the woodwork. I remember I lost my job in my house one time in 2002, and I had multiple offers for gigantic amounts of money and places to live. Like in the first week, I had maybe six offers of places to live and three offers of people that were willing to give me like 30 grand. I mean, that's like unheard of. I couldn't imagine that, you know. But that was the change that took place in it. Now, as far as a family member, when I was drinking, everything was about me. If there was a family funeral, it would be like, that son of a bitch died on me. You know what I mean? Now I gotta get a suit on, and I gotta stay sober for a funeral. He died on me. I was mad at him for dying. You know, that's and everything was about me. If there was a holiday or something, I'd make a big scene. You know, like, it was, somebody, what'd you say? what do you mean by, I know what you meant by that, you know, in the middle of like Thanksgiving or something, you know. I mean, that was the type of person I was. And I used to tell people, you know, we don't have a real close family. We're not a real close family. Well, I'm doing inventory a couple of years into sobriety, and I realized my family travels all over the country together. They go on vacations together all the time. They just don't bring me, you know. So what happened with the application of some of the recovery stuff? I became a better family member, you know. And in the last 15 years or so, I became the person who had the best ideas about how to help the family. I'm really the person who tried to help my mother when she started to become disabled and stuff. I was the one that was paying attention and trying to drag in resources, like my wonderful wife here, drag in resources to help my mother. And I was the person who always would get the house fixed. I was the person, if there was an emergency, like something wasn't working, I'd be the one called. I became a very, very valuable member of the family, you know, and I always wanted that kind of stuff. I was in my own way with my alcoholism. Now, alcoholism is really, really easy to make mistakes with when you get into recovery or you start your journey in sobriety, and it's very, very easy to work on the wrong problem. I'll give you a for instance. If you're working on the problem of not drinking, you can miss the whole thing. Because, yeah, of course we're not supposed to drink. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. That's primary, but that's not the problem. The problem is, in an unrecovered state, this is how alcoholism presents. On a good day, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. On a normal day, we're prey to misery, depression, self-centered fear, guilt, shame, remorse, anxiety. That's a normal day for an alcoholic who has not experienced recovery. On a bad day, it's the hideous four horsemen: terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Sober. Those states have to do when we're sober. So that's the real problem. That's why we need to address our spiritual growth. That's why we need to get a sponsor who will help us, help guide us through this recovery process. There's a couple of really, really great Bill Wilson sayings. One of them is on page 174 of the 12 and 12. It says, unless each AA member practices to the best of their ability our 12 steps, they almost surely sign their own death warrant. Drunkenness is not going to be something that is imposed upon them by the AA group. Drunkenness comes from inattention to spiritual details. And there's another great saying. I think this is from the pamphlet "Problems Other Than Alcohol." It basically says, "I'm terrible at quoting things," but I think it basically says in there. It says that the primary purpose of an AA group is the teaching and practice of the 12 steps. And then there's another piece of writing that Bill wrote I think it's in As Bill Sees It or Language of the Heart, where he basically says a sponsor's main responsibility is an adequate presentation of the 12 steps. So Bill Wilson was always focused on the core of our recovery process. He got really involved in fellowship matters. He got really involved in service matters. But when you go back to his earliest writings or his writings from 39 to 52 or whatever, or even later, you're going to see that he always was pointing us back to the 12-step process and how that can change our lives. You know, one of the things that I think is really, really important for me to pay attention to today is the chapter 7, Working with Others. I have made every mistake you can make working with other alcoholics. I've thrown ladders up on the side of a house and climbed in their bedroom window to drag them to AA. I mean, I have sponsored sociopathic non-alcoholics who were only in AA to rape, rob, and pillage, and they just wanted me to be their sponsor for cover. I mean, I have made every mistake that you can possibly make in AA. Now, I've gone back to the chapter working with others, and that's how I work with others. It's pretty strange that I'm working with others using the chapter working with others. I know that's unorthodox, but that's what I'm actually doing. And in that chapter, it basically tells us that when we find a prospect, we're supposed to tell them our story. We're supposed to share our experience, our strength, and our hope with them, the way Bill did when he went over to Dr. Bob's. If you remember, Bill Wilson was supposed to meet up with Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob is like, oh, I got some wacko from New York that's going to come and tell me about my drinking. You know, please, after 15 minutes, come in and say we have to go. You know what I mean? He found his escape. And when Bill came in, Bill surprised him. Bill just talked to him about his experience, his strength and his hope. Talked about his drinking. And this got Dr. Bob. This set the hook in Dr. Bob, you know, because all of a sudden he realized there was somebody sitting right in front of him who understood experientially what he was going through. And at best, these experiences where we're starting to work with other people, at best, the people that we're going to approach are going to realize that, yes, we know how they feel, we felt that way before, we don't feel that way anymore, and we can help them find the solution the way we found it. And that's really what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to tell our story, we're supposed to allow the other person to talk, we're supposed to gain confidence together with these people. Let them understand that we know our business with alcoholism, and we're going to then explain what the recovery program looks like. What I used to do is I used to say, I'll take you to a meeting, you know, I'll be over your house, I'll pick you up, I'll take you to a meeting. It doesn't say to do that in the chapter working with others. In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, someone would have to be like at step 9 before you bring them to a meeting. You know, because they didn't want to just bring people who didn't mean business to the meetings. You know, so you'd have to be doing step work to be invited to the meeting. So in this particular chapter, it basically says, look, explain to them the 12-step recovery process. Explain it through your own experience, how you did a 4-step, how you did a 5-step, how you went out and made amends, how you pray and you meditate, and how you work with other people. And then you basically say, do you want what I have? Are you willing to do this? Are you willing to go to these lengths? And if the person says no, you're to say, okay, here's my phone number. You know, if you ever change your mind, give me a call. But I can't help you. If you're not going to work the steps with me, there's nothing I can do for you. That's what we're supposed to do. And that's what I do today. So I do that. Look. Is it okay for people to go to meetings and languish in the back row, not being held accountable to any, you know, recovery process at all, and just share their garbage meeting after meeting? Is that okay? Absolutely. I'm very liberal in the fellowship. I almost don't care what happens in the fellowship as long as it's not a first tradition issue where somebody's harming the group. I'm almost okay with anything. But if somebody's going to work with me, if somebody's going to ask me to sponsor them, this is how I do it. If you don't want to go through the steps with me, I got nothing for you. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a life coach. You know, my God, I'm certainly not a drama coach. For years, these people, they'd never be willing to make any amends. They'd never be honest with their fifth step stuff. But I'd be working with them, and I'd be helping them manage an unmanageable life. How insane is that for me to be wasting my time helping somebody manage their unmanageable life? I can't manage my own life. Why would I be wasting my time trying to help somebody else manage theirs? So my sponsorship style has changed. Now, This has changed the type of people that I work with. You know, I only work with serious people. And it's cut down on the amount of people that ask me to sponsor them, you know. And I recognize today that personally I'm way more about quality than I am quantity. There was a period of time when I was saying yes to everybody. I had 50 sponsees, okay? 50 of them. Half of them are running around, you know, causing trouble. And there was one guy that was doing heroin and doing a big book study in his basement on heroin. I mean, it was just a debacle, you know? It's a debacle. I had a sponsorship breakdown, you know? And I remember my sponsor dragged me in. He said, okay, Chris, cut it out. You know, just stop. You know, I'm putting you on hold for 6 months, you know, and that's really what happened. And when I came back, I started to understand that, you know, I need to pay attention to what the book Alcoholics Anonymous says. If I do what the book Alcoholics Anonymous says, I'm not going to be wasting my time. You know, I'm not going to be wasting my time. I used to think, you know, well, that's kind of cruel, you know, telling somebody I'm not going to help them if they don't do the steps. It's much crueler to allow them to believe everything's going to be fine if they don't. You know what I mean? That's much more cool. Listen, the recidivism in Alcoholics Anonymous is horrible. I'm going to end with this one story. I told you all before that I'm kind of involved in some of the professional characteristics of addiction treatment. I'm a board member on NCADD and a couple of other things, and I get involved with different discussions. And I remember I'm on this LinkedIn site, and it's a LinkedIn site for addiction professionals. All these people are professionals, and here I am, you know, picking at them. But this one guy, get this guy is a psychiatrist. He's an addiction psychiatrist. He's somebody that if you're having problems with your drinking and you go to him, he'll talk to you for $200 an hour. You know what I mean? And in his writings on this chat site, he started to talk bad about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, listen, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't for AA. I wouldn't have anything in my life if it wasn't for AA. I'm incredibly loyal to Alcoholics Anonymous at a deep level. So I get pissed off when people criticize it. So this addiction psychiatrist is criticizing AA. And I shot a couple of things back at him, and you know, and he insulted me a couple of times. And finally he said, Chris, listen. He goes, Alcoholics Anonymous has a 6% recovery rate. He goes, I could do better prescribing placebos. That's what he said. And I'm like, oh, you know, I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, and I'm really pissed. But I have to think about this, right? Because it's true. The 6% number is true. I know where they get that. Where they get that is they've got college students doing their thesis or whatever, and they stand outside of AA groups, like usually in New York City or LA or something, and the people that come through, oh, would you answer a few questions? And they do a survey, and they find out things like, you know, how many years people have, and how many times people have relapsed, and they can put these statistics together. And it's true that only about 6% of the people that come through the door are going to be here in 5 years or 2 years still sober. That's true. You know, so I had to think, what am I going to say to this guy? Because this guy is so wrong. And this is what I came up with. I go, okay, you're a medical doctor. Let's say you came up with a cure for pancreatic cancer, and you nailed it, and you know that this is the cure for pancreatic cancer, and you want to put on a trial. So you get a hospital to work with you, and you get 100 people with pancreatic cancer to come to that hospital and undergo your surgery. But what happens is only about 10% of the people that come to the hospital go in for the operation. The other 90% sit in the waiting room and they talk about their pancreatic cancer. And they get a pancreatic cancer sponsor and they get the coffee commitment at the waiting room. And they're grateful they have pancreatic cancer. But only 10% go in and undergo the operation. I go, what would you say? Would you say that your cure is only 10% effective? He goes, no, I would only count the people that went in for the operation. So I said to him, I go, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That is still true. That's my experience working with people. The people that go through the steps with me, they're all still sober. Every one of them is still sober. The people that got through it and continue to work with other people and live in 10, 11, and 12, they're all still sober. So rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. That's still true. I said, you are counting everybody. You're counting the people in the waiting room. Not everybody goes through the steps. So you can't say we don't work. You know, there's two problems with this. One of them is the people who walk through those doors don't hear the true message. The message of you need to go through the steps to recover from alcoholism. The other problem is they hear that message and they don't believe it. They don't believe that in their case, the steps is going to be an actual process that's going to work for them. We can't do anything about that second thing, but we can do something about the first. We can be about the business of sitting people down and explaining to them what alcoholism is and what the solution to alcoholism is. We can do that. You know, then it's not our fault when they walk out the door and they don't come back. It can be our fault if we don't offer them the solution. Because they might, listen, I've worked with people that are so bad that if they don't get involved in the steps in their first week sober, they're just not going to be able to stay sober. I've worked with people that bad. And then there's people who've got longer grace periods. They can go years sometimes without working the steps. Decades sometimes. But how do you know? How do you know what kind of grace period they have? How do you know how long they can go without a spiritual solution? So again, I am incredibly grateful to be alive, to be sober, to be a recovered alcoholic today. I cannot tell you. You know, I understand what it's like to be a grateful alcoholic now. You know, so if you're new, that probably doesn't cheer you up at all that I'm a grateful alcoholic. But I do understand what that's about. I enjoy every single minute on this planet, enjoying this being a spiritual being, enjoying this human experience. You know, what a gift it is. You know, to be on this planet and to be able to, you know, be able to live this kind of a life. I want to thank Pat for asking me to come down, and God bless all you guys.